Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one.
It's the Politics Show cast.
Love podcasts, hate nonsense. It's the Politics Show podcast. How are we?
I've got my coat on.
Not ready. I'm going to call you out for two things.
Oh.
Listeners should know I just offered Ava the chance to do the introduction. Mm-hmm. Because I'm worried that sometimes people would critique Ollie and I for like hogging it and think it's like a sexist thing.
Yeah.
But you just don't want to say that you love podcasts and hate nonsense.
Yeah, I know. Like a year in, you suddenly offer it to me.
That's not true at all.
I haven't been hogging it at all.
You have declined it before.
Do you know, when we did that live show in Liverpool and neither of you were there and it was just me.
You got Ben Smoke to do it, didn't you?
Ben Smoke and Mick Lynch. And I had to say love podcasts, hate nonsense in front of like a group of people looking at me. And I was like... do you know when you can feel the tears like welling up in your eyes? And I was like,
why do you object to it so much?
No, because I was just like, this is so embarrassing. I was like, there's like all those people
they
looking
love
at
it.
You.
They, and then
you
go, they love it.
No, because that audience was like, that audience was a mix of people who liked Politics Joe.
Oh, and just they're interested in seeing Mick Lynch.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily our guys.
And so like the one person I was like looking at in the front row, she was like 75 odd. And I was thinking, what's she going to think of this? Like,
it's because she clearly is a paedophile and you don't want to alienate them.
Oh my God.
You object to the opinions of people who are pro-paedophile.
Do you have one of those things that Sacha Baron Cohen had during Made in America where...
The pedo detector.
Yeah.
No, I do. Second thing. Mm. What time are we rolling?
12.
What time did you start having lunch?
11:56.
At what time? Sick.
What?
Cool. That's the thing.
Oh, sorry.
In the interest of something to say. Yes.
Go on. What is it?
Timekeeping. Yeah.
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 All right, you and Ollie on that now.
Yeah. This isn't rolling. We're just having an HR review.
Yeah.
I'm your boss now. Mm. Do you have any notes for me?
Well.
No. Shall we? What should we talk about first?
I think we should talk about your favourite topic.
William Ragg.
Yeah.
Willie Ragg has resigned the whip.
He has.
After coward Sunak refused to take it from him.
And after Jeremy Hunt called him brave. He was so brave.
Can you enlighten me, us, as to why this wasn't like the quickest whip removal of all time?
Sunak was talking about that this morning and he was saying that some people will think I've made the wrong choice for it. And it's like, well, yes. And they didn't give any more detail. There's actually, when you look in hindsight because of how dramatically the story has changed, because also remember that when on the Wednesday when this actually broke, we didn't know who it was and we genuinely thought it was a Chinese state intervention. A couple of days afterwards when we found out that it was William Ragg. Mm-hmm. But I guess we still thought it was Chinese state intervention.
We don't know that's not, do we?
Yeah, but... Okay, fine. But if a member of the Chinese state sends you a picture of their penis, you don't then have to send them numbers of your colleagues and political journalists.
No, you do. It's polite. It's international diplomacy.
So I thought this was quite good fun. So obviously Hunt praised it. And then friends of Ragg agreed that he was a victim in all of this. Victim actually being used. And Charles Walker told the BBC... He'd been the subject of a sting operation by a very clever and manipulative operator. There's a lot of compassion out there. I'm not excusing what he's done, but I do think he is a victim in this, along with all the others.
I suppose what we don't have is are the messages that William Ragg received. Because all the ones that are from Abby and Charlie or whatever, that's after, well, William Ragg presumably passed on some of those numbers. So I would like to see what... the sophisticated messages, because they must have been bloody good to fall for that.
I think it's sad that someone got honey trapped like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's sad that someone was sent these unsolicited messages and then responded to them mm-hmm. earnestly. Mm-hmm. Like that is, I feel bad for mm-hmm. him. But there was no reason for him then to, once he's identified that this is not a real person or a person with malintent, he should not have just dropped all of his colleagues in. And importantly, not notified the people whose numbers he'd given over to him that this was happening.
Yeah, what's really funny is when, did you see Henry Zeffman on Newsnight talking about he got like the messages from like Abby or Charlie?
Yeah.
And reading about these messages, and it's always like, and did you fall for it? He's like, no, obviously.
Yeah.
No. I reflected critically. I was aware of, he wrote a thing, I think it was in the Times piece,
that would be Harry York.
No, excuse me. It was in the BBC article then. He wrote about being like, my first thought was, which sounded incredibly pompous, what if this is a foreign state actor looking for secrets? But like, if you work in Parliament or whatever, you probably should have that level of scrutiny. Or that, of like awareness of your position.
Yeah. If someone just out of the blue messages you and you are...
Claiming to have met you as well.
Claiming to have met you and you're quite an important person.
Mm, definitely.
I think that you should... Because... What else is happening? Are people just messaging them randomly, being like, hey, just to let you know, it could have been so much worse is what I mean. So like, it could have been that he blackmailed legislation choices out of him or voting intentions out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to say, judging on this performance, that he wouldn't have also succumbed to that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Numbers is probably like the least, numbers that people didn't fall for is probably the least damaging.
Well, do you know what the other thing that's actually been bugging me about this is that he resigned the Conservative whip, but he's still an MP,
so
as not to trigger a by-election. So I think that's what Sunak... That's probably the considerations that were going on in number 10, was that they didn't want to have another by-election.
Because the majority's almost halved.
Yeah, and I think... So it's probably been like, well, if we take the whip away from him, we know that he's already planned to stand down at the general election, so then he might just go, right, never mind, I'll pack it all in. And there's probably been a discussion with CCHQ, which is like, look, you can resign the whip. We're going to keep supporting you. Do not stand down from that seat. Do not trigger a by-election.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like, don't trigger a by-election because there's going to be an election.
No, because that wouldn't matter. That would just get subsumed into the...
Oh, yeah, I suppose, actually.
Into the general.
Yeah.
But
let's not waste our time.
But also, is that serving the MPs, the constituents of Hazel Grove particularly well, that they've now got an independent MP sitting there, who, by the way, we don't know, we'll see what happens when he next comes back to Parliament. But a few weeks ago, he was quite a desirable MP to have. You know, he was chair of the 1922 committee, he was sitting on a select committee,
mm-hmm.
And he had the Conservative whip. So, like, you know, that's someone who is representing you in a number of different parts of the party. That's quite a senior Conservative figure, right?
Yep.
It's a senior MP to have representing your needs as a constituent. Now he's none of those things because he's resigned, like none of them at all. And he probably won't want to turn up to the chamber to speak. And
or face his constituents.
Well, if you're, after all of this furore, do you think that he, apart from to vote, is he really going to go into Parliament and start doing interventions? Like, is he going to be like, Prime Minister, I have a question. I have one.
No. Or would you trust him? Say you, like, you have someone, you need help. Are you going to trust the guy who fell for this? Are you going to trust the guy who was thick enough to fall for this and then pass on?
He's like, I'm going to give, let me take your number. Oh, no, no, no.
It's actually, it's a privacy and data nightmare.
Mm.
You need to send him an order to delete all your information.
Yeah.
And see what he's passed on.
There was probably a bit of a real worry, actually, when this story first started, you know, coming out properly, or being, you know, the details were being revealed, that if you're someone who has sent sensitive information to William Ragg, you're probably thinking, oh my God, there's been Chinese state intervention mm-hmm. on William Ragg's phone. There's been a hack. They're going to have access now to loads of my details. Mm-hmm. There was probably a real earnest panic about that if you've sent him something compromising that, like, the Communist Party now has it. And actually...
What can we do? So the Tory majority is now down to 45, is it? And
sick.
I don't know. Would you have believed that another chunk of the Conservative majority has been knocked off because someone couldn't keep it in their pants?
That's interesting, because that means that only 23 people now have to vote against a Conservative policy for it not to pass.
Only 23. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. Good maths.
That's slim, that, isn't it?
Yeah, very slim. I thought it'd be fun to come up with some ideas about try and predict what the next Tory scandal will be.
Ooh, go on.
I think what's going to happen is, do you remember that scam that was going around? I think it was happening quite regularly 2 or 3 years ago. You'd get a WhatsApp and it would be from like CEO of your company and it'd be like, I need your help urgently. I need $4,000 of Microsoft points. And like, they'd be like, oh, yes, of course, because they'd usually target quite junior people who never interacted with the CEO before, so they'd go off down to Tesco and buy £4,000 worth of Google points or Microsoft points or whatever, then send them on. It's going to be found out that quite a junior Tory MP has, maybe a 2019 intake, has been pretending to be Rishi Sunak and instructing other MPs to send them Amazon vouchers. Yeah. Thousands of pounds worth of gift cards. And like the threats are like, we will deselect you if you do not do this.
And so there's like a much older, maybe like nearing the father of the house.
Yep.
who's been, what's it called? Loads of money has been taken from him.
Frauded.
Yeah, what's that word?
Stolen from?
Extorted. He said, hundreds of thousands of pounds extorted.
Bill Gash is in poverty.
Okay, I've got one.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a change to... So do you know that they wanted to make it... there was talk of making it criminal that you couldn't advertise on, like, Spare Room, that someone could... Like, a young woman could live in your house for free, but they have to walk around naked the entire time.
Yeah. Yep.
They have to get rid of that piece of legislation because an MP realises he's accidentally been doing that.
So, in this scenario, an MP has a lodger, and instead of paying rent,
she's obliged
to walk around naked. And he's done this accidentally.
Well, he doesn't realise that that's not okay. But she's not from the Chinese Communist Party.
No, she's just
she's from Iran.
A naked maid?
She's a refugee.
Oh, I thought you wanted people to house people from Ukraine. Okay, this is woke gone mad.
Yeah.
Screaming about it.
Okay, another Tory MP, mm-hmm. hypothetically.
Yep.
Has... gone down to the Dover coast to teach someone a lesson about crossing the channel.
And done the reverse.
They're now living in his house. And he realises he's accidentally taken in a slave.
Oh my God. You keep saying accidentally. You're giving them in this hypothetical, you're giving them a lot of credit.
So they have to rehaul all of the Modern Slavery Act.
Because they've been guilty.
Well, if you were just trying to make a political point, then it's okay.
Yeah. I think one of them is going to be done for cheating at Fortnite or something.
Why are you also
just different priorities, isn't it?
Okay.
One of them might don't know, shoot someone. That'd be good.
Sorry, I checked out for 1 second and then I came back in.
That would be an interesting scandal.
Right.
If a Tory MP shot someone.
Okay.
But in quite a grey area, not like murder.
A grey area way.
Like, who was it that shot? Wasn't it like Reagan? Nixon maybe? Shot someone when they were hunting. No, it's Cheney. Dick Cheney.
I thought you were going to go down the hunting route, yeah.
And you were in my way!
Okay. A Tory MP takes out a load of constituents to go fox hunting. Mm-hmm. When they turn up, he doesn't have enough horses, so he's like, well, you can just run alongside us. And
you can be the fox.
Yeah, he accidentally makes his constituent the fox.
No, he accidentally introduces the greatest game, the hunt of man.
Yeah.
Bring back man hunting
into
Dorset. I think that'd be quite a good...
It's good, though.
I think we could get people behind that. People should be able to consent to being the fox.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad I've rounded that up.
Have you got any more?
I think I'm dry.
Okay.
I'm spent. Do you have any more?
No. I mean, I could, but I think they'll get worse.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think they'll be... With all the news that's happened today, they'll be furious.
It could be like that pledge at the early... That near pledge at the early Reform press conference where they accidentally really nearly reignited the Troubles.
Remind me of that again.
Where they were like, oh, we should send troops into Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you accidentally undo the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah. Tory MP.
You invite the IRA to Parliament.
Tory MP.
You think it's be quite like a good like cross-community thing? Man sitting there armed.
Tory MP sends nude to IRA man.
Now, if you're in the IRA, get in touch and tell us if a Tory MP has ever sent you a picture of the dick.
You know what was, you know what's funny to me is that there are very few Tory MPs who understand what flag goes with what part of Ireland.
Yeah. It's so complicated, isn't it?
I think it was Sunak or Sunak's press officer.
Oh, what was that again? They used the
Well, he was talking about Great Britain and the Windsor Framework, and it was like, what's that got to do with anything?
Yeah, fucking morons.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's the Politics Show cast.
So the cast report came out today and it says that children who have been let down by lack of research and remarkably weak evidence on gender issues. It was a 4-year study exploring gender identity services for under 18s, and it was announced by the NHS after there was a sharp rise in the number of people questioning their gender. So it concluded that there is no clear evidence on whether social transitioning has a positive or negative effect on mental health outcomes. It also suggested that 17 to 25 year olds go through follow-through care until the age of 25. It also recommends, amongst other things, that clinicians treat patients' issues in a kind of holistic manner, so they don't just see them as you're here because of your gender issues, you're here, you also are autistic, depressed, etc. Trying to create a kind of sense of holistic care for young trans people.
So it's actually got a lot more questions than it has answers. It's not the way that it's been billed this morning in quite a lot of the media is that this is this landmark review that will put an end to children transitioning. And actually, that's not what Hilary Cass was saying in the report at all. I'm going to say something and just try and find the nuance in this. It's actually a really interesting report because what she's talking about, particularly what she's talking about when children can't access local services because local services are so frightened of the toxicity around the debate that they basically just go, oh God, we can't handle that child, so I'm going to put them into a gender identity clinic. And then that means that they then go on a waiting list for 4 years and then eventually they might get puberty blockers. But what she's identified is that there's no services that are holistic. There's no holistic approach to transitioning. So it means that if you're a child experiencing gender dysphoria, you don't get to go to therapy. And a lot of that is to do with the binary nature of the debate, because it's so hard and fast in each camp that it means that basically local services are too frightened to intervene or get involved.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fascinating. It says so much about the state of mental health in our country that you cannot access therapy easily at all. You know, if someone's experiencing gender dysphoria when they're 12 years old, even if they are the perfect candidate for puberty blockers and they should go on them, the idea that they would go on them without having their hand held to have no therapy during that seems totally nuts to me. I just think as well, like, it's exposed the kind of, I'm not really saying this word, messianic? Yeah, the messianic zeal of anti-trans campaigners, because they've hijacked this report and said that it's vindicated them. This is exactly what the feminists have been talking about for years. You know, some people are so intolerant of the alternate point of view that young children might need to access services. And I'm not saying they immediately have to access puberty blockers, even though some cases they might, but they might actually have to access therapy, that they're just so blind to the needs of these children. It's so unhelpful.
Yeah, and I think the holistic approach Cass recommends is definitely to be welcomed, because obviously that's being trans is pretty tough deal to have to deal with. There was a woman in, right, I think she spoke to the Guardian today. She had a trans child. She said, I've got the quote here somewhere. So a parent of a trans child said to the Guardian, do we really come across as the kind of parents who are absolutely delighted to have a transgender child? We might be the kind of parents who'd be absolutely willing to support our transgender child, but in an ideal world, I would much rather my child was growing up in a way in which she wasn't sticking out like a sore thumb and potentially going to end up dead.
Mm.
Which I think is like, what I think a lot of the discussion about this seems to be, is when people talk about trans people talk about as if there's some sort of weird conspiracy to like make kids trans, which doesn't exist, like fully doesn't exist. And I think that perhaps some of the dangers of this report, not dangers, unintended consequences, perhaps might be like talking about the introduction of the follow-through service for some between the ages of 17 to 25 and people not starting treatment until the age of 25. I think it's really quite, well, what can you do? Imagine all the things you can do when you turn 18.
Yeah.
That you like, you can drink, vote, join the army, etc. But the idea you can't, I don't know, express your gender correctly, it's pretty
well
strange.
That's because she was in the report, she's talking about how there's not enough evidence to say that socialization is helpful for someone experiencing gender dysphoria. So she's basically saying that there's no just because you've allowed a child has changed their name or is identifying as another gender, there's not enough evidence to substantiate whether that is beneficial. And it's probably because the pool of reference is so small. You know, this is a topic that has engulfed the country. We talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
And when you actually look at the numbers, like, if you were to put them as a dot on the map, you would not see that dot. It would be like, where's Wally?
I think it's also maybe important to note with this report is they rejected a lot of the studies out of hand. I couldn't, like, a ton of it. They've rejected for not being high quality enough. Which I didn't really seem to be able to understand the rationale behind that?
Because there's so few. I mean, so that, do you see the graph that showed like from 2010-ish, the rise in the number of children who are looking for looking for help with gender dysphoria has significantly increased. And she pointed towards like, well, it might be social media, but like couldn't conclude whether that was because they weren't documenting the children enough back then, or whether that was because children didn't know that that was the dysphoria they were experiencing. Mm. They didn't understand how to put it into words, and they might do now.
But then is that, but there must have been studies done about that before, and Cass basically says we're rejecting all previous hundreds of studies that have been done because they're not high quality enough. And also on that point, I think, why is there more trans people or gender questioning people now? It's maybe because the same reason there's more left-handed people now than there was 100 years ago. People have stopped trying to suppress it.
Yeah, you stop burning them at the stake.
Yeah, people like, if you, it's like representation, isn't it? Like once you realise that, like, oh, this is actually something that I can,
no, totally,
can be,
that's why I think social media has been really helpful for people, because it's sort of, it allows you, it's sort of like, you know, when everyone gets really angry about this uptick in the number of people who have ADHD or who have autism, or, you know, you basically just realize that they're on the spectrum and people get really angry about it. And it's like, why? Social media has been great in like allowing people to understand that some of their behaviors that they didn't understand are linked to something. And so that they can, it just makes you, you feel better. You can socialize yourself better when you're aware of why you're acting in a certain way. Do you know what I mean? Because otherwise, a lot, you know, you're there going, well, why am I so different? Why are all of them allowed to, like, I don't know, be in this really crowd, tight space, loud area? And that makes me panic, have a panic attack. Why is that happening to me? And then you might get diagnosed with autism and you go, oh.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. What you were talking about before, about there's this idea that we're trying to make everyone trans. That's the fear. And I think that that's probably to do with the sort of breakdown of gender norms that's been going on or been happening for the past 20 years, where, you know, on a very basic level, where you're like, oh, girls like pink and boys like blue. And now actually, you know, it's quite fashionable to dress your children in either colour, no matter of their gender. And that's like the really soft, fluffy, basic end of it. And I think that some, then you get like, you know, up until probably they're about 10 or 11, children of all genders play on the same sports teams in a lot of schools. And that gets conflated into, instead of going, oh, girls and boys actually can interact in the same spaces in a lot of, you know, a lot of the time, and they don't need to be separated. That sort of gets conflated by the right-wing media into everyone is going to be trans, you know?
Yeah, it's become like a spectre that means all things. It can mean all things to all people. I think something to be said as well about the current state of trans healthcare, in that people seem to think that you present at a gender clinic, say, I think I'm trans, next thing you're having gender-affirming surgery and being given estrogen to transition. No, that's not remotely the case. The waiting lists to, like, for medical transition are years and years and years and years. And people, and it's linked to a lot of trans suicides, is that they've been on a waiting list for so long, they felt that they haven't been able to, they felt that they're not being listened to, and they're not going to be able to ever get into this thing, because gender dysphoria is really pretty horrible. Imagine feeling like that. It's something, it's like we talk about it a lot, but it's something that the vast majority of us will never ever experience.
Yeah.
Like, we're incredibly fortunate to feel comfortable in the bodies that we are born in and to be identified with the genders that we were assigned at birth. And so I think there's just a stunning lack of empathy in the, it's like the, oh, you are, oh, you feel this way. Oh, you are wrong for feeling it that way. Oh, you're a freak. Oh, you are this, especially considering the rate. I really don't think the idea that someone would volunteer to take on this life exists. Like, considering the rates of violence against, like, trans women in particular, and suicide rates amongst trans people, and, like, the stigma. Imagine being, like, imagine volunteering to have Julia Hartley Brewer talk about you every single day. I think it's
well, the
crazy.
human element has been has been lost because of the right-wing hysteria over it. And actually, well, there's a lot of left-wing hysteria on it as well. But yeah, the hysteria, you've lost out the person. I also just think that we're giving up a lot of ground a lot of ground that decides what is right and fair for trans people and how they should be accommodated or how we can accommodate them because we're, you know, on account of one or two criminals. So, like, what we've basically done is gone, well, okay, so self-identification, it takes years and it has to be signed off by a doctor, We need to be wary of that because there might be one weirdo who uses this system so that he can go into a girl's changing room and wank himself silly.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're compromising all of these people for a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be as nuts as saying, like, we need to put, this is a very different example, we need to put all of the LURPAC behind an iron security rail because there's one person who might steal it. Like, it doesn't... I just think that huge compromise that we're doing as a society is actually, like, it's almost an indictment of our ability to identify a wrong'un.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's quite clear if someone is going through the self-ID process because they would like to identify as another gender because that's how they feel that they are. Mm. Compared to, say, someone who's like...
an opportunistic criminal.
Yeah, you know. I just wouldn't mind going there, mother loose. They're a lot cleaner, aren't they? You know, it's just so obvious.
Yeah, it's like in, like, those old films, like, it can't happen anymore because of woke.
Yeah.
Like, when men would pretend to be gay in films and just do, like, the most, like, broad caricature. Like, the character's, like, they need to pretend to be gay to get a promotion or something like that, and they wouldn't get the details right.
Yes, and it would be like the most ridiculous caricature, the most like over-exaggeration.
Something I think is missing from the discourse, which I think people should do, is just like, I've kind of touched on it there, but just I'd like some more empathy in the debate for trans kids, especially.
Out of me?
Out of you, especially. Mm. You say some horrific things on camera.
Don't say that.
No, she doesn't. She does.
No, I don't.
She doesn't. Not about trans people, other people. But I think there should be more, just empathy. I think it'd be like, this would be quite a scary day for trans people, for people like, if you've got a trans child, I think that's like, their life is probably going to become, if these recommendations are implemented, a lot of them would probably make their life a fair bit harder.
Well, to have your body politicised pretty much every day. You know, Wes Streeting came out with a very quick statement in response to the CAS report, and he was talking about, like, yeah, absolutely, we would implement all of these measures. And I was reading that, and I was thinking, I'm going to make a note of that, because that means that you're going to now implement mental health hubs. That means that you're going to improve the spending on therapy that's going to be, available to anyone who needs it. Because it's not just about... this is actually pointed out in the report, it's not just about the gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. It's about how there just is a total lack of mental health services. Yep. So it means that even if you don't know what you're experiencing, you don't get the opportunity to go and talk it through.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're extremely depressed, you don't, you get put on a drug rather than getting to, going to discover why you might be really depressed. You might be depressed because... I don't know, you've got an underlying, you've got PTSD, but you don't know about it.
Yep.
That's not going to be helped by not talking about it and being fed drugs. In the same way that being given puberty blockers without any therapy is not going to lead to a healthy transition.
Mm-hmm. There's also, a fair bit of the report talks about people who detransition, which is interesting because that's like such a tiny minority of trans people.
Yeah.
And it is like, obviously, if you've gone through this process and you regret it, fucking horrific. Fair enough, you should be supported. But centering your approach to this around the worst case scenario, which happens like so fewer than people who have like healthy adults, and like it's really like...
Well, ban lip fillers, ban Botox. Ban anything that could be
the phrase is life altering, isn't it?
Tattoos.
Yeah, that's the point I think about, like, between people are talking about, well, what are all the life altering things you can do before the age of 25? Like, you can get married, you can have a baby, you can get a tattoo.
You could join the army. You can't reverse that decision, can you?
You can move. You can move to a different country. And so what? So why are people able to do that when they turn 18?
Yeah, it's the policing of your body. Because it's so nanny state, actually, which is quite interesting because you think that... actually, this government is very nanny state.
Yeah.
It's a very evangelical government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... There, actually, no part of their policy has been laissez-faire for like years. Mm-hmm. It's all been like even the smoking ban. That, no, but
back to me.
No, but seriously, that's a real intrusion into your privacy. Being told that this is we've decided we don't want you to do something,
mm-hmm.
and so we're going to make it illegal for you to do it.
Yeah,
that's not conservative in any sense of the word. Like, to be told, like, you should be allowed to go and take puberty blockers. You should be allowed to go and take, you should have gender reaffirming surgery if you want to. And then if you later down the line decide that you didn't want that, then that's your cross to bear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not the government's job to be telling you who, what, where, when, how.
Yeah.
Least if they want to tell you what to do with your body, at least provide a service where they go, right, well, okay, we're not going to let you do that for 2 years, hypothetically. Mm. I know that the timeline is much longer than that. You need to go to therapy every single week for 2 years. And if you still feel the same way at the end of the 2 years, then a doctor will sign it off.
Mm.
And until you provide that provision, you shouldn't be at the table having the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's also maybe a danger in that as well, though, because you need to like maybe... police the people giving the therapy, because like you said, like they might just, I don't know, bring in conversion therapists in the NHS.
Oh yeah, for sure.
The NHS is under pressure. They might outsource it. To conversion therapy.
He's got rid of that conversion therapy ban.
I know, what the fuck is that about?
I'm telling you, it's a very evangelical government. I think we'll look back on this, especially, I think in GCSEs in like 20 years' time, they'll be like, well, with the rise of the National Conservative Conference.
Miriam Cates dictates the policy. Osama bin Laden did New Labour. Miriam Cates did the Conservative policy.
Yeah.
Who's worse?
Who's worse?
Osama bin Laden or Miriam Cates?
I'm not going to answer that.
I think there's a really obvious answer.
Oh.
Miriam Cates. You thought I was trying to get you.
Yeah, and I got myself.
I mean, who could possibly compare? I don't like comparing the crimes.
Shut the fridge.
It's the Politics Show cast.
But speaking of the, you know, the sort of rise in conservatism, there is... Well, there's actually been quite a lot of chatter about banning abortion, or sorry, pulling back on abortion legislation. Right now, it's up to 24 weeks in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been quite a lot of chat from actually Conservative MPs those weeks should be reduced. And Stella Creasy, who is the Labour MP for Walthamstow, will be coming in. We're going to speak to her in a minute about what she wants to do, which is decriminalise abortion.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's hear from Stella.
Stella, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Watery-eyed.
Aren't we all?
Because it is not the spring we were promised.
No. But that's...
That's the next piece of legislation.
Yes, exactly. I think it was Matt Letizia yesterday who said that it was the government who calculated making it hot during lockdown and cold when it's not.
Well, you know, I mean, there's got to be some power somewhere,
yeah,
hasn't there?
He's thinking big here.
Yeah. Not watch too much Netflix at all.
No. Okay, let's start with the bill. So what are you proposing? What is it that you want?
So there's a group of us who want to learn from countries around the world where abortion has been decriminalised. I don't think a lot of women in England and Wales realise they don't actually have a legal right to an abortion. An abortion is still illegal in this country. It's just that we have legislation that exempts them from prosecution if they follow certain rules, which includes seeing two doctors and basically having to explain why they want an abortion, because otherwise it would make them go mad. And you might say, well, okay, that's a philosophical thing to deal with, but actually it has real world consequences of people's access to abortion, because if you have to get several appointments, that can cause delays. I think abortion is a healthcare, not criminal matter, in which case it needs an underpinning which is about healthcare and proper regulation, which is about accessing it in a way that is good for your health. And one of the things that we think would improve access is to decriminalise abortion up to the existing time limit of 24 weeks so that you can make it easier to access an abortion earlier on in a process. And also, frankly, to not have to explain yourself, because it's your choice. It's not a matter of public discussion. And if we decriminalise it, then it becomes about abortion being able to accessible to women when they would like to within that 24 time week.
Well, so talk to me about this 24 weeks, because yeah. I think this is the bit that's I've personally been actually quite confused about. So are you saying you want to decriminalise it up to term or up until 24 weeks?
No, and the amendment that we have put forward keeps the integrity of the 24 week limit. What it does say is post then, and we recognise there are instances in which this happens, and there currently are in the current situation. So in the current situation, if there's a medical reason, and actually you really want to protect those, because those tend to be the abortions that are the most heartbreaking of all, when you've got, say, a fatal fetal abnormality, a baby that will not live if it's born. I don't think the state should be making any woman carry to term a baby they know is going to die. What we've said is that we would, like a lot of other countries, have retain the legislation that we've got, but you have the Director of Public Prosecutions who would decide whether or not there was any public interest at all in pursuing either a woman or a medic who assisted her within good faith post those 24-week limits. So it's decriminalisation up to 24 weeks, and it is then basically taking... Only in the very extreme circumstances would you want to have any kind of involvement of the DPP, and really saying this is a healthcare matter. Because what we're seeing right now, and the case for decriminalisation is overwhelming, is there's been a real uptick of investigations and prosecutions of women. So 15-year-old girls who've had a stillbirth or didn't even realise that they were pregnant, ending up with a police officer rather than a counsellor standing at their hospital bed. The challenge is to get this right, to recognise where decriminalisation would help improve access to the services, where it would recognise a woman's right to be able to have an abortion, and to do so in a way that also protects the 24-week limit and protects that people feel that there could be instances in which it would be right for the DPP to be involved. But that's an incredibly high bar. I mean, there's very few other areas of law where we would have that bar, and it would bring us into line with a lot of other jurisdictions that have decriminalised abortion and said... Well, we think it should only be available up to 24 weeks, except in exceptional medical circumstances, and we would retain that. But we would also recognise that having a criminal foundation on something that is healthcare is out of date in the 21st century.
So with this explanation, I think this sort of... this is very confusing.
No, I recognise, because I've already had a number of people, you know, Isabel Oakeshott and Neil O'Brien... saying that somehow we're talking about abortion at birth. Nobody is talking about abortion at birth. And frankly, it doesn't help anybody to have that kind of inflammatory language. It's also why the most critical part of the amendment that we are proposing is to learn from Northern Ireland. So in Northern Ireland, abortion is actually legal, unlike the rest of the United Kingdom, and it is decriminalised there. But crucially, in Northern Ireland, the Secretary of State has a direct responsibility to ensure that women can access a safe and legal abortion under those regulations, so under the time limits that exist. What that means in practice is it means that the Secretary of State has had to do battle with all those people in Northern Ireland who do not agree with abortion at all and who sought to use their position, whether in the civil service, in the NHS, in the police or in any public service, to try and thwart access. Because remember, up until a couple of years ago, there was no access to abortion in Northern Ireland.
And there still isn't in a lot of areas as well.
But it's changing because the Secretary of State has had to battle these people. We should be really alarmed in this country. The anti-choice movement has been fundraising. It's got millions of pounds. It's much more organised. It's very active in our NHS. It's active in our civil service. It's active in Parliament. What this amendment also does is it brings in what I would call the Northern Ireland lock. So it designates somebody in government whose job it is to ensure that women can access that legal right that Parliament says that they should have if it passes this amendment. And we believe that's really critical because, as we saw with buffer zones, so Parliament voted for buffer zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales 2 years ago. We still don't have them. And indeed, the government is currently running a consultation to overturn that by the back door. That is a consultation that has been written, signed off by not just one Home Secretary, but countless officials. There are people who would seek to thwart access to abortion, who would use the opportunity of abortion law reform to argue for guidelines, regulations, secondary legislation which is what we've seen with buffer zones, having that lock from Northern Ireland would mean they couldn't do anything that was punitive, that would prevent access to abortion. And that's why Northern Ireland, they have buffer zones already, because it is part of the human rights framework.
So you would still be allowed to stand outside and silently pray?
Under the government's plans, that's not explicit what Parliament voted against.
Right.
But you see, this is the challenge, is the anti-choice movement is licking their lips at the idea that they can use the positions that they have to be able to undermine access. And we've seen it before. We saw it before on the myth that somehow there was sex selection taking place and the arguments they put forward there. Already we've seen attacks on the term limit. And as I say, often those abortions happening at the latest period are the most tragic and the ones we need to protect the most, because they're for people's medical needs. What we see with this amendment is three things. We see decriminalisation, improving early access to abortion, because you want women who choose to have an abortion to have it as early as possible because it's the least invasive. They can take pills rather than having to have a medical procedure.
Also, if you're on the argument of pro-life, that is the time that you would be pushing for those earlier abortions, because that is...
Well, but you see, a lot of these people are arguing against what we could call telemedicine, against trusting women to make those decisions, because actually what they don't want is women to have access to abortion at all. The second thing, as I say, it does is to tackle that challenge post 24 weeks and give a defence to medics. It gives a defence to women. It sets an incredibly high bar about when you would ever want any involvement of prosecutors. And the third thing it does is bring in this Northern Ireland lock to protect us against any future legislation or regulation that would undermine access. So it's trying to recognise that the case for decriminalisation is overwhelming, but how you do it is probably more complicated than any of us would want to be, operating in an environment where, frankly, women's bodies are the battlefield of the culture wars.
So just to get one thing really clear, because I think this is something that's been perhaps confused in the write-ups or the discussion of this. So after 24 weeks, would you want women to be able to go to their doctor and have the ability to access an abortion out of choice? I'm not talking about a medical circumstance.
Well, no, that's currently not the situation. So the situation at the moment is that you can access an abortion at a later stage if there is a medical case for it. And we trust doctors to be involved in that. That wouldn't change. That is the settled will, that there will be circumstances, as I say, fatal fetal abnormality is a classic example of this, where to ask a woman to carry a baby to term because that fatal treatment has only been identified post 24 weeks is seen as a hugely damaging thing to do. And I trust doctors and women in that circumstance, as we do under the existing law. So we're not talking about tampering with any of the time limits. What we're talking about is improving access at an early stage, recognising that even post 24 weeks, really this is still a healthcare matter, but you retain some of the criminal legislation to provide a background to that 24 weeks. I mean, that's where the law is settled in England and Wales. And then crucially, bringing in this Northern Ireland lock to make sure that no reform of abortion is used to roll back access. So, for example, to try and tamper with people's access to telemedicine or to not have buffer zones so that you make it impossible for women to physically visit an abortion.
The telemedicine is quite a big debate in this country, isn't it? Because that was something that was available during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And whenever we talk about now, like, you know, should women be able to have at-home abortions? I think it sounds sort of like it's some kind of medieval procedure. Mm. But instead what happens is that you go to a clinic and you take the pills there. You would like it to be available at home.
Well, so actually it currently is. We currently have telemedicine, and now the vast majority of...
I thought it had been taken away
after
COVID.
No, they tried to take it away post-pandemic. Right. We voted to continue to have it because it is about making it easier for women to access an abortion earlier on in their pregnancy.
Right.
Once you get past 10, 11 weeks, then it does become a medical procedure. That is incredibly invasive compared to being able to take pills. And I think, as I say, all of us would want to see women who choose to have an abortion do so as early and efficiently as possible, frankly, so that it is not as invasive for them as it would be at a later date.
Just one little point of clarity before I ask you the next question. So if a woman after 24 weeks had done something silly to themselves at home, you would want that to be decriminalised?
We're not talking about, but what we're talking about is saying that there would only be very exceptional circumstances in which that would be seen. I'm not going to prejudge those circumstances. I think this is primarily a healthcare matter, but we are retaining, and I want to be really clear, because there will be people online who will try to argue otherwise. Mm. And there are other amendments that don't. So this is, I can only talk particularly about the amendment that we've put forward. We're retaining the idea that the Director of Public Prosecutions would look at whether or not it was required to use that legislation. We should be clear that even if you take away all this legislation, there are other criminal offences that would remain. One of the things that's really troubling, for example, is we've seen a lot of crisis pregnancies being investigated and prosecuted under the 1800s piece of legislation because prosecutors felt they couldn't prove other offences. But there are other all sorts of other offences about there's murder. If you really think that is what has happened, we're talking primarily about the legislation that sits underneath abortion itself.
But I think this is really important, and I understand that you're reticent to answer this question, probably in the way that you would like to, because of the online furore. But I think it's really integral to the point. So if you're going to decriminalise abortion with women, and you know someone has done something stupid to themselves at 30 weeks, well, you know, after 24 weeks, then that would they would not go to prison for that. I think that's what this legislation is saying.
We're being very clear that there shouldn't be any prison or incarceration. I don't think people felt that Carla Foster, who was the case people know, and in fact the public overwhelmingly said, look, she shouldn't go to prison. She had three other children.
Yeah.
It didn't mean that there wasn't something there that needed to be investigated or that there wasn't a safeguarding issue. Those safeguarding regulations would retain, in any case, they already exist. What we're saying is the threshold, the reason why we're concerned is because there's been this massive uptake of 40 investigations in the last year alone of women for having an abortion in of itself.
Mm.
So not post the current regulation, but having an abortion, because that's the way the law is written. And that influences both how services are provided. It means that there is a fear, and particularly talking to gynecologists who deal with stillbirths, that they're really concerned to see police turning up at the at the bed of someone who's had a stillbirth, which is when somebody really needs a counsellor and they need support. What we're saying is that the evidentiary test of any form of police involvement must be much higher, and it must be at the level of the DPP.
It always feels like when we have a discussion around abortion, I think that the two extremes sort of take over the grey area, the sensible grey area that is in the middle, because what you're saying is entirely rational, but it has the ability to be misconstrued or misinterpreted. And one person who did that, you mentioned earlier, was Conservative MP Neil O'Brien. And he said that Stella is arguing for people to be able to kill a baby the day before it's due to be born and face no consequences. This is an incredibly extreme and bad proposal. Is that what you're advocating for?
No, absolutely not. And Neil hasn't seen the words of the amendment that we as a group, and it's a cross-party group, so this is not a party political issue, have tabled, because it's a quirk that right now Parliament isn't sitting, so the amendment doesn't appear on the order paper for him to even have seen, for him to say such things. But what his words do speak to is a ratcheting up of the debate and discussion around abortion in this country in the way that we have seen in America. And I would appeal and urge anybody who considers themselves to be pro-choice not to be complacent that what has happened in America with the attacks on a woman's right to choose would never happen here in England and Wales, because they do not realise how access to abortion is under a sustained and persistent attack. That is one of the reasons why we want to bring in this Northern Ireland lock as well, to prevent those attacks from happening behind closed doors. Because what is driving this increase in prosecution of women for having an abortion in of itself isn't entirely clear. It hasn't come from anything democratic or anything through Parliament. It's come from possibly the NHS or people within the police who don't support a woman's right to choose. I would appeal to Neil to perhaps look at the words before he speaks and understand actually what this amendment will do and how it retains the integrity of the 24-week limit, and that would guide what services were provided. I say, with the caveat that where there were cases post 24 weeks, that would be covered by the current medical exemptions that we already have. And also to recognise that if you consider yourself to be pro-life, you know, restricting access to abortion, using this kind of inflammatory language, doesn't stop abortions. It just stops safe abortions. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen time and time again, and we're now seeing in America, is the consequences of when you restrict access to a safe and legal service. And the consequences are that women die.
And the same thing with Hungary. But there are actually quite a few pro-life Conservative MPs. I think what's interesting is when the topic comes up in Parliament, the number of MPs that are willing to stand up and say that they don't agree with abortion. So you're right to say that it is, we are sort of teetering on the edge of it not being taken away. But there is a danger there that we could, well, I won't be hyperbolic, but...
Well, let me then, as somebody who has lived this debate for several years and been subjected to campaigning and targeted attacks by some of these people, and I say that as somebody who has also sat down with people who are passionately against abortion, whether in my own community or nationally, and had perfectly decent and reasonable debates. But the inflammatory language and the insensitivity, I've had these people in my community telling people that I want to kill babies and put them in bins, harassing my local community, putting leaflets through everybody's doors with graphic imagery on in my local area. This is an American-style tactic that we have had imported into this country that we didn't have when we last did work on abortion reform. And we've seen it in the NHS. We've seen a growing level of anti-choice activism. And it is anti-choice. It's not pro-life, because, as I say, you put women's lives at risk when you restrict access to abortion. That is not to say that these people should guide what we do in terms of service provision, and that we shouldn't try to make progress and learn from other countries that have decriminalised abortion and what that's done to women's health there. But it is to recognise that there will be a backlash. So you need to get ahead of that backlash if you actually want to achieve the goal that we want, which is to have a safe and legal and hopefully local service for women, that if they make that choice, they are able to make it in dignity and in privacy.
Do you think the Conservative Party has become more evangelical since Rishi Sunak took over?
I think there has definitely been organisation. On a practical level, we've seen organisations like Right to Life recruiting lots and lots of staff. That requires a lot of money. We see much more activism within Parliament from the anti-choice movement. It cuts across Parliament. I want to be very open and honest. This is not a party political issue. I know there are people on my own side who disagree on a woman's right to choose. I think the point I'm making is that it has become a much more contested issue than perhaps those who consider themselves pro-choice would recognise. And I would be extremely wary of not being able to overcome that, because at the end of the day, what we all want to do is make sure that women can access a safe service.
When you know that, I mean, next year we're going to have the National Conservative, actually maybe later this year, National Conservative Conference, and, you know, Suella Braverman is going to be speaking on the same stage as Viktor Orban. When you hear things like that, you know, serving Conservative MPs, standing alongside extremely, conservative in the actual, you know, in the sense of the word, figures, does that worry you about, you know, where women's rights could go in the UK?
Well, we've seen that women's rights and women's bodies are the battlefield of the far-right culture wars. We've seen it not just in America, but in Europe. I sit here, I'm the chair of the Labour Movement for Europe, and I'm also talking to my colleagues in different countries around Europe. You know, people might be worried that Trump might win the American presidency, but they're not looking at Orban, they're not looking at Giorgia Meloni, they're not looking at Geert Wilders, the rise of the AFD, Marine Le Pen in France. There is growing organisation of a far-right political agenda that uses what you might term equalities issues as its gateway drug to power. And women's bodies and women's rights have been at the forefront of that. The powerful story is Poland, where it was women who organised and resisted, and they did so on the basis of defending their right to choose what happens to their own bodies. And that's what led to the success of Donald Tusk. And I think there's a real concern for many of us that we are sleepwalking into having those debates here in England, or not even recognising the role that the UK could play in partnership with our colleagues in Europe in standing up for progressive values, because we think it's on the extremes, it's on the fringes. It's in the heart of the UK Parliament already. It's very much in the debates that are happening at a grassroots level. This is a good example of where, as you saw in that tweet, the extremes are starting out with the conversation. The reality is a much more thoughtful, measured proposal that is seeking to balance people's concerns about time limits, concerns about regulation, and concerns about a woman's dignity and equality. I hope that's the debate we can have in Parliament. I fear in the coming days, as we get to this, it'll be the heat, not the light, that people will see coming forward. I just urge people not to be complacent that somehow people aren't responding to that or reacting to that, because actually, whether it is on women's rights, whether it is on how we treat trans people, whether it is on how we respond even to refugees, these battles are being organised and fed by that international rhetoric, but they are very much having a consequence in our homes.
And final word, read the amendment.
It's an old-fashioned, you know, obviously that's what makes me, you know, fit all the kind of bugbears. As somebody who campaigns to work with our European partners, who supports women's rights, old-fashioned idea, maybe read what's on the paper first before deciding you don't like it. Mm.
So that was Stella Christie speaking to Ava. Have you got anything else to add before we wrap this up?
What would I add? I haven't done the interview yet.
Anything in particular?
Let's leave that.
They don't know that. That's going to be the magic of editing. Yes. So that's, isn't that weird? Stella's about to be interviewed in about 7 minutes.
Mm.
And you guys have just watched it.
Yeah.
God.
God. Time. Bending space
and you're
time.
And you're watching this in about 7 hours.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in Cumbria then.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. What, cum?
Nice.
are you saying nice at cum?
No. Brie.
Mmm, cheese. Imagine you were like that. Imagine you were like a mmm, yummy.
It's like when cat people, like.
Yeah.
I like, it's fine if you like cats.
No, say it with your chest, what you're about to say.
It is fine if you like cats.
No. I want no caveats. Give me a full opinion on cat people.
You know, when they're like posting, like, Stella's here. Cut.
No, say your cat people thing. Say it. Okay, Ava's a way to get Stella. I'll tell you her real opinion about cats. This is my opinion about cats. Some cats are really fucking ugly and disgusting. Two of the last cats I interacted with were the most minging animals I've ever seen in my life. I'm a dog person. Ava hates animals. Okay, we're still rolling, Ava.
Well, look, now we know.
Ava's going to post something anti-trans on the internet. Okay, Ava's away to go and speak to Stella. I'm going to Cumbria. Hope you all have a lovely evening and thank you very much for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.